The days of having a job and building a career and worked for 30 years and had a great retirement, and those days are over. I watched all that crumble.
I would much rather volunteer my financial resources to someone who I know is aligned with me in some way. I'm part of this community, even if I don't know them.
This is the trap. All of that stuff, more is better, and if you live out of more is better, then what you have is never enough.
If you're going to save or invest or however you want to frame it in something, are you going to do it in Bitcoin or are you going to do it in something else that is much more manipulable and completely within the confines of the system?
In today's world, you have to be willing and able to think for yourself and to search out the sources that make sense and to trust your inner knowing about truth. And question everything.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. As always, today on the show, I have Bobby Rometto. Bobby is a client of the Bitcoin Way. Incredible guy, incredible story. He has a fantastic book out called The Prosperity Rebellion, where you can get it at his website. Stay tuned, check the show description. We have a fantastic conversation about his awakening to the fiat slavery system, how he found Bitcoin, and everything that transpired in between. Just an incredible story. You are really going to love this one. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Bobby here with me. Bobby, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you, Michael. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm grateful. I love the Bitcoin Way and the content you put out. So it's a real honor for me to spend some time with you today.
I really appreciate that. We're going to have a good conversation. So I am one of the probably a relatively small handful of people who have officially read your book, The Prosperity Rebellion. And what I love about it, I told you, first of all, you're a fantastic writer. It's a short read. I'm a slow reader, so it took me an hour and a half, maybe two. I think for the average person who's a little bit smarter than me, maybe an hour. But you cover basically your story as a young person, as a professional. And it's an interesting one. It is it's one that I think many people would just enjoy hearing where you came from and the many perspectives you have. I want to start, though, with a particular book that you read that changed your view on the system in which many of us find ourselves, and that is The Creature from Jekyll Island, and how that transformed your beliefs about our world and how it led you down this path toward trying to create a Bitcoin before there was Bitcoin. So why don't you tell me about The Creature from Jekyll Island, where you were at in your life and the influence it had?
Yeah, it was a very interesting time for me. I've been a kind of a founding member of a company called Homevestors of America, a real estate investment franchise. The brand is We Buy Ugly Houses. My family, we moved to Kansas City, the Midwest, and opened an office there and started buying houses. The model was buy old beat up houses at a discount, rehab them, resell them, originally with owner financing to people that couldn't get a bank loan. And the business was good. It was strong, and we were doing really well. And then I read The Creature from Jekyll Island, and you know, people ask me about that book, and it's, I don't know, 400 pages. You know, it was a long read and a very depressing read at the same time, but invaluable, because I really started to understand how the system works, how the fiat system works, the creation of the Federal Reserve System, the central banks, and, you know, basically the corrupt monetary system that we have today. And it kind of shook me, because I was in an industry where it was an integral part of that game in the real estate space. They're tied together so closely. And I had a previous experience 10 years before that. In my first lifetime, I guess, in the investment world, doing some development projects. And I remember in 1986, there was the TEFRA Act, the Tax Act of 1986, and financing stopped, interest rates went up. I was in the middle of two projects and got crushed because some people made a decision about money and how much was going to be out there. And so I was affected by it then. And then when I read The Creature from Jekyll Island, it really awakened me to the system. And the challenges and the basically the corruption of it and the manipulation of people's wealth. You know, the silent theft that inflation is, that money printing is, and it's, you know, people just aren't aware. We don't know. I was a pretty intelligent human being. I went to Carnegie Mellon University, you know, degree in business and economics, a double major, had no idea. They don't teach this. They keep it hidden. They keep it guarded. You know, it's very fascinating, Michael. We're in the age of Aquarius now. This is my wife's alley. You know, she's into this space, but we're moving from the Piscean age to the Aquarian age. And this is a really nice overlay because in the Piscean age, everything was hidden and guarded and protected and held by a few. So information was kept close. And in the Aquarian age, you can't keep a secret today if you wanted to. You know, you have to work really hard, but everything is being exposed and the old structures that dominated and controlled the world are starting to crumble, be it governments, religions, all of it. So this is just kind of an expansion of that into money, and Bitcoin does that. You know, it's...
Yeah, so... And so you were sort of at the forefront of understanding this, because there are many people today... And maybe it's just the world in which you and I sort of operate now. We tend to see people awakening, and it's harder for me to recognize if that's a broad shift in thinking, or if it's just because I'm surrounded by Bitcoiners and that's sort of my online community and the people I work with. But when you read The Creature from Jekyll Island, you got involved in a couple of projects subsequently. Could you explain the? I think the Liberty Dollar for me is probably the most interesting. I would be curious to hear how you got involved in that and what it was, and maybe just kind of tell the whole story, because it's fascinating. They effectively crushed you in the end.
Yeah. When I realized what our monetary system was, I got very clear that I needed to find something that had real value that I could save in. And cause I didn't want to save in dollars. And when I started looking into that, I looked at silver, right? I looked at silver, I looked at gold, and silver seemed to be more accessible, more uses. I think I started buying silver, it was around $16, $17 an ounce. And going down that rabbit hole of being a silver bug, I guess, I ran across a man by the name of Bernard von Nothaus. And Bernard was a character. And I never remember meeting him at a Holiday Inn in Clearwater, Florida. He was driving the country in his car, telling this story of something he called the Liberty Dollar. And what the Liberty Dollar was an alternative barter currency backed 100% by silver. Bernard's background was he used to own and run the Royal Hawaiian Mint. So he was a mint master. He would create silver rounds and, you know, beautiful coins. And he realized and really took a stand against the fiat system. He understood the corruption and the damage it was doing to people. And the idea with the Liberty Dollar was to use it to help insulate local communities against a dollar that was being debased. So he set up regional currency officers, of which when I found out about this, I became one instantly. I said, that's me. I want to do that. So we would buy silver, Liberty Dollars, take them into local merchants in our community and ask them to buy them and distribute them as change to their customers and accept them as payment for their services. So to create a little economy in your local community of people that were actually transacting in real silver. So he had 1 ounce tokens, half ounce. He had warehouse receipts that were much more attractive than monopoly money, but they look nothing like U.S. dollars. And they were backed 100% by silver that was housed in the Sunshine Mint in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. So this was 100% backed silver alternative barter currency. And we started to gain traction. There were regional currency offices in various parts of the country. In North Carolina, there was a Walmart that was accepting Liberty dollars for payment. It was gaining momentum. And one day in 2009, I believe it was, the DOJ and FBI showed up at the Liberty Dollar headquarters in Evansville, Indiana, and confiscated everything. They went to the Sunshine Mint in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and confiscated 16,000 pounds of silver that was there. And ultimately, a prosecution came down against Bernard and the Liberty Dollar in North Carolina. And a lot of different charges, but the primary one was counterfeiting, if you can believe it, which I found fascinating. And because this was never marketed as U.S. currency, clearly we spelled out clearly what it was. It was an alternative barter currency backed by silver and in no way U.S. money. That's what we were trying to get away from, in fact. So a conviction came down in 2011. They actually convicted him. The DOJ prosecutor actually called Bernard a domestic terrorist, if you can believe that, and talked about how, you know, this was a form of domestic terrorism, undermining the dollar, like as if they need help in that, right? So, you know, it was crazy because, you know, the man couldn't travel. You know, he was on a no-fly list for a while, couldn't rent anything. He was a convicted felon. The interesting thing was they never sentenced him right away. I think it was the longest felony conviction without a sentencing. It was 3 years before the judge sentenced him. And
why do you think that was?
Well, it was really fascinating. The judge came out. It was the last act before the judge left the bench was to sentence him. And he sentenced him to 3 years probation. The conviction could have been 25 years. But in his what he wrote about it was very telling. And I go into it in the book. But he basically said this was a miscarriage of justice. This was a horrible prosecution. That in no way was this counterfeiting. If anything, Bernard and the Liberty Dollar were very clear that this was not U.S. money. And it was just a, you know, a miscarriage of justice. So he ended up, I think, 6 months probation, and then they commuted it and let him go. But I'm still in touch with Bernard today. And he was a man that was really ahead of his time. And this was another great example of trying to fight the system from within the system. You know, there was Bernard, who was the face of the Liberty Dollar, and then there was Liberty Dollar, the company, and centralized, could be attacked and crushed, and it was. And, you know, so that was difficult. That was another hard pill to swallow. I experienced three big moments in my life. After one before reading The Creature from Jekyll Island, and then two after, that were real awakenings for me. And what that led me to ultimately, Michael, because there, I was pretty depressed and shut down at that point. I felt like things were hopeless. And it took me almost 7 years to clean things up with the IRS, because I was a part of the tax honesty movement and watched them crush people there, not being able to discuss the law in the courtroom. You know, the judge would say, I'll instruct the jury as to what the law says. Well, your whole defense was, what does the law actually say? And you couldn't talk about it. So it was very clear that the government was not going to let anything happen to their system from within the system. It, no matter how corrupt, no matter what truth was, it didn't matter. So it was a 7-year process before I could get back being productive again and earning money without threat of confiscation. And when I did, I really changed my views on a lot of things that I couldn't hear. I think Bitcoin was mentioned being somewhere around 2012, but I couldn't hear it. Like, I didn't want to hear anything. I was in such a state of mind that I was just trying to figure out, how do I get back on my feet? How do we generate income? I felt like I'd blown my opportunity to create some generational wealth and take care of my children and my family. So I just put my head down and went to work. And in a different way, though, and from a place of real presence. I did a lot of deep spiritual work from 2005 on, and I still do. And that really had me look at my life and become responsible for the actions I took, which gave me back power to do things and change things. And it was 2018 when I heard the word Bitcoin again. And then I was ready to hear it. And when I saw what it was, I realized this was what I've been searching for. This was the way out. This was the peaceful protest, the peaceful rebellion. And didn't have to paint a target on my chest like I had in the past. And so that was a start for me.
So you've sort of lived, you've been ingrained in fiat. You tried building a parallel system with silver as the backing. And obviously, to me, I view that as something external to the system. The problem is what you pinpointed is the centralizing factor of silver. You got to have warehouses and some place that you keep it, makes it easy to confiscate. And now you're a Bitcoiner. How do you view what money truly is? And how does Bitcoin for you honor the essence of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it speaks to something I want to share. Back in 1990, I read a book called Your Money or Your Life. I highly recommend it. It's by Joe Dominguez and Vicky Robin. And in it, they talked about, it's the first time I read anything that said about their definition of money was something that you trade your life energy for. So we have a finite amount of life energy, and we trade that life energy for money when we go to work, right? Then their question became, so how are you using your life energy in the world once you convert it into money, right? So again, this was 1986, but I think it was like 1990 I read the book. So it had me become aware of where I spend, you know, that kind of stuff. I started looking at, are those things in alignment with who I say I am in the world? Because they talked about something called the fulfillment curve, Michael, and they said that your spending, as it goes up, it generates a certain amount of fulfillment. The curve goes up. The more you spend, the more fulfillment you get until you hit this point on the curve called enough. And they said you always wanted to be at enough and a little extra. And the only way, if your spending continued beyond that amount, the fulfillment would crash. It would start to fall. And we see that. We see that in people's lives where they have a lot of money, spend a lot. They got 6 cars, 5 houses, but they're unhappy and they're unfulfilled. So they said the only way to continue to gain fulfillment from spending is if your spending is in alignment with who you say you are in the world. So it had to be an expression of that. Your spending had to be an expression of who you say you are. So what I realized was, well, I should have had it figured out back then, right? Because I understood money and I understood how much is enough. I found that out. But the programming, and this is the trap. We are so trained today and programmed that more is better, right? The newer car, the bigger house, you know, the second house, all of that stuff, more is better, more is better. And if you live out of more is better, then what you have is never enough. And you're chasing. And that's the trap that they want to catch us in, to continue to spend, to continue to consume, and to do it unconsciously. You know, we look, you know, I ordered a protein drink today on Amazon this morning. It'll be at my door at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Like the world is set up for that instant gratification to buy. Now there's some nice things that had that convenience. The only thing that'd be better was if I could have used sats to buy the protein drink on Amazon. Maybe that'll come someday soon. But, you know, we're programmed to consume. We're trained to consume. And that's the trap. We have to keep the system running, right? To perpetuate the game. What I noticed when I saw Bitcoin, the challenge was when we trade our life energy for money in fiat, that fiat doesn't honor our life energy. It devalues our life energy because they keep printing more. So the like our life energy isn't honored by it. But in Bitcoin, I call it sacred money because it honors our life energy. There's only so much of it. 21 million, that's all there's ever going to be. It can't be debased. It can't be confiscated. Like, it's, you know, for me, it's a spiritual, there's definitely a spiritual component to Bitcoin because of that. And it's sacred in my mind. And so we have the opportunity to save in something that's sacred, that honors our work, that honors our life energy, rather than something that devalues it, something that is designed to keep us numb to it and unconscious. So we continue, not only is it being stolen through debasement, but we're trained to unconsciously spend it on things that don't matter way beyond enough. So part of my work is to help people get conscious again around that. Like, where are, because people will say, God, I don't have an extra $25 or $100 a month, or what, I don't have that money to put away. And I promise you, if you spend an hour with me, we'll find that money so that you can start to honor your life energy again.
Yeah. I like the way you frame this in the book as well. You said more is a mirage. The closer you get, the further it moves, because the system was never designed for arrival, only for endless pursuit.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, in Bitcoin, we have like these sayings that you don't have enough, you haven't stacked enough. And there are people who are early on in their journey, and to the extent that they really want to preserve their wealth for the future and to, you know, accumulate, they're in a savings phase. I think there's truth to that, but I think it's not necessarily helpful for everyone, because at the end of the day, at least in my view, money is a tool, and it's a tool for preserving what you'd call your life energy. I think Jack Mahler says that money is your time and energy in abstract form, something to that effect. And however precisely you frame it, it's what you're exchanging your time for when you're working. And there comes a point when you should have enough, and you do have enough, whether you begin to appreciate it or not. In my experience, the beauty of Bitcoin is you begin to, it makes it much easier to recognize when you're there. It's a process figuring that out, because you have been conditioned for so long, like most people, to think that there is more on the other side. The grass is greener. If I just, you know, could accumulate, what have you. But I think at the end of the day, for me at least, and it seems to me like this is a lot of your thesis here, is that Bitcoin, it rewires the way that you view the world, and you view what is necessary in your life, and it helps you to prioritize and focus on the things that matter most. Is that maybe a way of summarizing a bit of what you're getting at here?
Yeah, for sure. I think that, and again, that ingrained way of looking at wealth and money through fiat is a tough one to break. You know, I love what Tony said the other day. I was listening to him on some podcast, and he said, look, if you're caught on the number, you know, and you look at 0.03 Bitcoin or 0.004, whatever you just bought, and it's like, oh God, I'll never get there. He said, stop thinking it in terms of Bitcoin and look at how many sats you have, right? If you like a big number, look at sats instead of the BTC, right? Bitcoin's 100 million sats. So like it'll start to shift your thinking around the number anyway. But we've been so trained to look at that number, right, as a measure. And it's really about what is our purchasing power, right? It's about that. It's about how have we stored our wealth and honored that. And so you know, I find it interesting that, you know, the idea of having to have one Bitcoin or two Bitcoin, who knows? Like, all I know is there's trillions and trillions of assets in the world that are going to find their way into Bitcoin. And whatever that number is going to be, it's going to be, but it's going to be big and you have to get some. You know, that's why my message, and that's why the book is only an hour long. It's an hour read. I just want people to get through it and take action. Get through it and start. You know, get an account with River and start buying and accumulating Bitcoin, right? Get some. You have to protect yourself. And actually, you know, I think it's even beyond that, Michael, the act of moving from fiat to Bitcoin is an act that will start to shift the consciousness of the world, right? Because why do we have war? How can we fund war? The only way we can fund war is through fiat. You know, that's like we, and, you know, I don't talk about in the book, I didn't get into conversation at all about left, right, red, blue, none of that, because that's the trap. They want to keep you looking at those things to create more division, more separation, so you don't see the bigger picture. Because all that game is the same. None of it changes, no matter if it's, you know, a Republican administration, a Democratic administration. It doesn't matter. Nothing changes. They keep the printing presses running. They keep funding things. Their solution is always to throw more money at it, which continues to steal from us. So without our approval. So by saving in Bitcoin, you're starving the system that is robbing you. And that's the peaceful protest. That's the way out. That's the prosperity rebellion, to really take control of your savings, of your money, to truly own it and not fall prey to what's going on. To like really take a stand.
Yeah. Amen to that. We had a comment, someone on our YouTube channel just the other day that I responded to, and someone said that they had missed the boat. They explained how much Bitcoin they had, which, by the way, I don't recommend you do. But they said, you know, I'll never be able to accumulate enough. And on one hand, there's a part of me that looks at it and says, okay, but what else are you going to accumulate that's going to better preserve your time? If you're going to save or invest or however you want to frame it in something, are you going to do it in Bitcoin, or are you going to do it in something else that is much more manipulable and completely within the confines of the system? But two, the unit bias thing that you sort of hinted at is a really important thing, because the reality of Bitcoin is that its addressable market is in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. Now, how long it takes to get there is anybody's guess. Everyone's got their model. Everyone's got their hunch. You know, it could be 5 years. It could be 20 years. It could be 50 or 100 years. I don't know. But at the end of the day, at some point, people will begin to ask the question, why would I want to hold anything else besides Bitcoin? And you've spent a lot of time in the world of real estate, and it seems like that's the question you had to start asking yourself once you discovered this. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about that sort of mindset and how you, as you shifted out of real estate and you've become a Bitcoiner, what that's looked like for you?
Yeah. You know, real estate had always been a vehicle to accumulate wealth because of the fiat system, right? Like, and in fact, I think Jack Mahler's had a podcast, it might've been yesterday, where he talked about how so much money has shifted, that like people are using real estate now as money, as a savings vehicle. And they've monetized it that way because now they're putting money in. So he mentioned a friend of his who got outbid on three different houses, either by an institution or by people buying second and third homes, right? So the price is being driven up like that because it's becoming monetized that way. And when I was in the game of real estate, it started to gnaw at me a little bit because of what I saw happening in the system. And I watched in 2008, the crash, right? And I saw so many people get devastated and crushed by that because of the manipulation again, right? And guess who gets bailed out? You know, here is, you know, the banks are getting bailed out. And where does that money come from? Us. You know, people don't see that. So, like, I've rented for the last 10 years simply because I see Bitcoin at, like, I would rather put the extra money in Bitcoin than a bigger payment that I have to own the house. Because I know how, if you look at housing versus Bitcoin price, I think it's like in the last 5 years, it's decreased 88%. Like, housing prices have gone down relative to Bitcoin, right? So, and I think there's a bigger crash coming in the real estate market. I just do. And so, you know, I'm struggling with, my wife wants to buy a house. I know where she wants it. I know what it's going to take. And I'm trying to justify in my head, do I want to put that capital there into that asset, or do I just want to keep stacking? And I'm pretty sure I just want to keep stacking right now. So that'll be a conversation to have. But, you know, like, I don't think the timing is right now. You know, so for a number of reasons, but, you know, but to move into, I think that's one thing about me. I'm an old guy, right? Older, young at heart, but I've always been open. I've always been open to learn and study and uncover and look for a better way. I've always been a self-directed thinker. Really didn't care what anybody thought. Got me into trouble sometimes. You know, when you think you can take on the federal government and the IRS, that could get you into trouble, and it did. But at the same time, it's kept me open, and that's why I was able to actually hear the call to hear Bitcoin in 2018 and start to move in that direction. And it just made more sense. It just makes more sense. If you're going to save, that is the place to save.
Yeah. I think that's the hallmark of a Bitcoiner, is the willingness to learn and grow, change your mind, be curious, remain curious. And, like, I've seen that shift in my life. My wife and I, and actually we were sort of victims of the system too. We bought some land, started building a house in what would have been 2022, 21, before I got into Bitcoin in earnest, at least. And, I mean, we got rug pulled. Interest rates went way up. And so the math I had done to, you know, once we move from construction loan into our mortgage, here's what I'm going to be paying. I mean, we're paying tens of, you know, percent more for our mortgage. And I'm waiting for interest rates to go back down. There are a lot of things, knowing what I know now about Bitcoin, that I would do differently. I don't view our home at all as an investment. It's an investment in my family.
Yeah,
we have property and room for the kids to play and run and roam and explore and have fun. And I don't regret that. Financially, it has not proven, in light of what happened, to be the best option. But as long as it continues to be something that we can afford and sustain, it continues to be good for our family. You threw out an interesting term there. You said self-directed thinking. Could you talk a little bit about that? What do you mean by that? And I think you told me offline that you find this to be the new financial edge that people can have.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, I think our education system today has, and it's not just that, it's happened over decades. We've trained people to not think, like to not use critical thinking about anything. We blindly accept things. And for some reason, some fortunate reason, I've never fallen into that trap. And, you know, I think it was probably when COVID hit that I really started to have compassion for people, because I could see how strong the programming is, how strong that if somebody says something on TV, it's just accepted. And like, this is, again, not a left or right, because people blindly accept what they see on CNN and people blindly accept what they see on Fox. And it doesn't matter. They're not thinking for themselves. And in today's world, you have to be willing and able to think for yourself and to search out the sources that make sense and to trust your inner knowing about truth and question everything. Like I've always done that. And you know, I always say, you know, when I went through my trials and tribulations with the federal government and, you know, the IRS and those battles, I put my kids through a lot. I put my family through a lot. It was a painful time. I became a really angry man because of the injustice I saw. And, you know, through the deep work we've been able to do together as a family, healed all that. But one of the things that I'm most proud of, I think, with my children, is they all are self-directed thinkers. They don't accept anything at face value. They study, they investigate, and they listen to that part of themselves that just knows. There's a part of you, that intuitive space that you have when you really slow down, that resonates with truth and feels off when it's not. So to me, that's the edge. Like when you can slow down and really pay attention to what's going on in the world and check in with yourself, does this feel right? And actually do some investigation rather than blindly accept. You know, that's an edge today, because so many people don't. And if anything, you know, my work today is to help people wake up to that part of themselves that knows, to get them to slow down and to think rather than to blindly follow anything. And, you know, it's becoming critical to be able to do that in today's world.
I think it even more so into the future. I agree with you, because I think as we migrate away from fiat onto a Bitcoin standard over time, the people who are going to best serve society, bring value, and justify being paid in a scarce form of money like Bitcoin are going to be the people who are curious, ask questions, and think for themselves. There's probably a case to be made that on a fiat standard, picking your tribe and falling in line might serve you, but that's becoming, being tribalistic is a less useful skill now and into the future, from what I can see, than it has been historically.
For sure. Like I said, that, you know, we're in that Aquarian age where those old structures are falling apart, right? Like the days of having a job and building a career and being with, you know, I grew up in Pittsburgh, you know, that U.S. Steel job that was great. And you worked for 30 years and had a great retirement, and those days are over. I watched all that crumble. And, you know, it takes somebody's, you have to be able to think on your feet and move with the changes that are happening in the world. Technology is moving so fast that if you can be aware and learn how to use it and, you know, become effective and bring value to people, you know, that's the real key, I think. And that's kind of when I got back on my feet again, I started to look at how can I bring real value to people. And, you know, fortunately I was able to find mechanisms that allowed me to do that with people. So, you know, in the book, I talk about presence. I talk a lot about that. And I had one of my mentors said these two words. And if it's all I ever remember, he said, I'll remember these two words. He said, presence heals. And the power of being able to be present with another human being. And I think this is going to become critical in the years to come, because there's going to be a lot of people in a lot of pain. Unfortunately, I don't see how this shift or transition is going to happen without some people struggling in a big way. And you know, Michael, I love what you said when we first talked. You talked about if like one family member in a family unit can become a Bitcoiner, and if at least they'll be able to help the people that they love and care about. And I agree with you 100%, you know, so I think it's going to be important for people to connect with each other, to be present with each other. And just in the act of doing that, it will be healing. And when times get tough for people.
Yeah, it's for me, that's really the goal for what I do is, and the reason we put out this content and share the message of Bitcoin is because in my experience, it's very hard to break people free of the thinking that they've done for 20, 30, 40 plus years. And for anyone, no one was listening in on our first conversation, but yeah, it's my belief that you may well be the only Bitcoiner in your family or in your group of friends, and take self-custody, run a node, keep stacking, keep learning, keep digging deep, because I think there is a point in the future where a lot of people begin to turn to the individual in their life who made these decisions, dug deeper, stayed curious. I've got a question for you, though. This is a selfish one, but you said one of the things you're proud of with your kids is that they're self-directed thinkers. This is, so my quick background is 3 years ago, I was a very different person before I found Bitcoin. I had picked my tribe. I was, you know, Mr. Patriot, and I believed all these things that I was 100% convinced would never change in my life. I was completely dug in. And you know, sure enough, you study Bitcoin, you go down these rabbit holes, you learn how the world really works, you read The Creature from Jekyll Island, you read the Bitcoin Standard, and everything begins to change. And so we're homeschooling our kids now. And I think a lot, my wife has sort of she's the one running the ship, but she's doing sort of her part. And okay, how do we teach a six-year-old and a four-year-old the fundamentals, the basics, reading, math, and all of that? And I tend to think a lot more about how do I walk them through something like history, which I think is very important to understand and is not so black and white as it's taught in a typical public school or even a good private school. They teach you that this is what happened in the Revolutionary War. This is what happened in the Civil War. This is what happened in World War II. And the rabbit holes I've gone down have indicated maybe it's not quite that simple. And it's not that I necessarily feel like I have all the answers, but I'm at least asking a lot of the questions. How did you, was there something you did intentionally to guide your kids through that process, or were you just really lucky?
It's not that complicated, I don't think.
Okay.
I think who you're being will teach your children more than anything. I'll give you maybe the best story I can share about that was, I carried a lot of guilt after the experience I had and the loss that we took and pretty much lost everything. And it was a lot. And in, I think it was 2014, we were in a family experience with my wife and children and the facilitator. It was kind of a conversation session. And she had each of us say, if there was one thing we could give each person here, what would it be? Right. Then my oldest son, who probably took more of the brunt of my anger at that time than anyone, he's very thoughtful and he's thought for a minute or two. And he looked and he said, I would give my dad the ability to forgive himself. He said, because he's my hero because of what he did and what he stood for. And that was like the most freeing thing I could have experienced, was for him to say that. So it's less about what you're teaching and more about how you're living, I think, that will open something up for your kids, that will allow them to think differently than everybody else does. Because Michael, you're different than everybody else. You know, just how you're perceiving the world and how you're moving through it now is enough, like, you know, and you're uncovering things and learning things. You had somebody on a couple of weeks ago talking about who was homeschooling their children. I remember listening and I thought, how cool, like how he's doing that. And you were like, oh, I think I'm going to incorporate some of that. Right. So you're open and you're learning and you're discovering. And my recommendation is just keep being you, live you. And that example will be more powerful for your children than any lesson. That's the lesson that you want them to get.
Well, thank you for that. That is incredibly helpful. And maybe a good message too for anyone to hear, because one of my biggest concerns for myself, it's not a concern that I have so much anymore, because I think I'm just so interested in learning and uncovering the more truth as I go. And I've learned that I'm as stubborn of a person as I think I am, and my wife would probably tell you I can be at times. I'm very open to changing my mind at this point. And my encouragement to anyone listening is to keep digging, keep reading, keep learning, keep listening to new content. I hope you love what we're sharing here, but don't just listen to me and my opinion and the guests we have. Go find other people who give alternative perspectives, because that's the way that you continue to grow and open your mind. But I appreciate that. I hope you're right, that just being the type of person that I want to be and I want to impart on my kids is probably going, they're just watching your every move.
Yeah.
And they pick up on things that you, I mean, we've learned this as parents. Yeah. They pick up on things that you just wouldn't even believe. So I like that.
Yeah. That level of authenticity that you live your life with is probably the greatest example you can give your children.
Yeah. So, Bobby, you mentioned, I think in our previous discussion, you talked about how the fiat system enslaves even quote unquote successful people. I think there are a lot of people who would take, to some degree, would take issue with that comment. I think I understand what you're saying, but there are obviously people, the Cantillon effect, for example, people at the top who benefit immensely, but even, you know, more normal successful people who are buying those second and third vacation homes and rental properties, and it looks or feels like they're winning. Yeah. Could you maybe elaborate on what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that's really what I'm speaking to. I think that's the trap, right? Because they're unconscious around how they're using their life energy in the world once they've converted it to money. And that creates a pressure to continue to perform rather than slowing down enough to say, who am I? You know, why am I here? What is my purpose? Right? Like I said, like in Your Money for Your Life, they say, like, unless money becomes an expression of who you are, this was a great line. Unless money becomes an expression of who you are, you will never have it. It will always have you. And so a lot of those people who look successful financially are still caught in the trap. They're on the treadmill. They've given up choice because of the programming that's so strong. They don't get to slow down and really check in with themselves and say, how do I want to express myself in the world? Like, what difference do I want to make? What contribution do I want to make? You know, like, so, you know, that's the trap. You know, the other piece too is like, I always say you can study and understand the spiritual laws of prosperity, right? You can understand all of that. But if you're trapped in a system that doesn't honor your life energy, it doesn't matter. You're falling behind. You know, so when you stepped into a system that can honor your life energy, that sacred money that Bitcoin is, and then use that as an expression of who you are in the world, like, we can change the world. Like, war doesn't have to exist. People don't have to starve. Like, you know, that's the one thing. I'm kind of an anarcho-capitalist, I guess. I don't know how much good government does. But I think it operates off the assumption that people wouldn't take care of each other. And I disagree with that. I feel like if we were operating in a system where our energy was honored and it wasn't being devalued and debased consistently by money printers and the people that run all of that, that people would actually take care of each other because they'd be able to. They wouldn't be caught in survival. They wouldn't be chasing more is better. And you would slow down enough to understand that there isn't a you over there and a me over here. That we're really connected. That if we could see the ultimate reality, we would see there's no separation. And we would start to take care of each other, because when we take care of each other, we're really taking care of ourselves. And sound money, sacred money, gives us the opportunity to do that.
I completely agree with that. So I had I had someone on the podcast I'm trying to remember who it was. We were talking about basically like the, first of all, everything you just described, that basically government steals from you, extorts, and you end up with less and less, less, first of all, financial ability to care for other people, but also less time to think about anything beyond your immediate needs and your family and your life. I think if you weren't routinely having 40% of your take-home income taken away, stolen immediately, and then if you weren't having an additional 7% money supply growth year after year, at least what we've seen for the last 20, 25 years, I think it opens people up to the ability to just be human and to look and recognize when there's a need and a problem to solve. I know who it was. It was Andy Schoonover. He's the CEO of CrowdHealth. So we canceled health insurance last year, moved to CrowdHealth, and we were talking about, basically, he's formed this community of 10,000 clients. And when you have a medical event, you pay the first $500, and then the crowd pitches in and helps you out. Yeah. And then when you don't have a health event, you're pitching in to help them. And it's like that. What he's designed is basically the most human form of health care backstop you could possibly have. And he's just systematized it and made it convenient with an app and everything. But it doesn't even make financial sense for me at the moment, because I've got little kids. So we go to the doctor urgent care and it costs $150, and I never meet that $500 threshold because we never have anything major. And so I'm dumping money into this. But when I get that email each month saying, hey, we need you to chip in $250 to help someone who had, you know, a heart attack, or it's like, I would much rather volunteer my financial resources to someone who I know is aligned with me in some way. I'm part of this community, even if I don't know them, than to fund the health insurance companies who are going to try nickel and diming the doctor that I go to, and I'm going to end up paying more. And who knows if they're actually going to cover my big medical expense. It's just a matter of like aligning yourselves into these systems that just make more sense, and where you have a choice and you are sovereign in some capacity, whether or not it's perfect. I feel like that's kind of the world you're describing that we have an opportunity for.
Yeah. I love that he's doing that. Like, technology today is creating the opportunity to have so much efficiency in those areas. And the one thing that the government will never be described as efficient. That word will never fall there, because it's the most inefficient, corrupt organization there is. And so technology is creating these opportunities. You know, it's very interesting, because even back in the home buying business, efficiency is changing that world, the real estate investment world. Like, the days of wholesalers who used to be out there and tie up a property at a huge discount and then sell it to another investor who would then sell it to another investor because there was that much margin in the deal, and the loser was the consumer. The loser was the seller, because they didn't know. They didn't have the information. They had no clue what their property was really worth in whatever condition it was in. That's changed today. Like, those margins are getting squeezed tight. It's becoming an efficient world, which is great for the seller. And it causes, you know what? It causes the investor to become better and stronger in other areas. now I got to become a better rehabber. I got to become a better manager of people. I got to find more ways to be efficient with materials and this and that. So like technology is creating efficiencies that are changing things daily. And we have to be aware of that, and we have to pay attention. And Bitcoin is a part of that technology. It's like super efficient money. It's as efficient as it can get.
So one last topic I want to cover here with you. I asked you for some ideas for things we could cover. You said spiritual sovereignty meets financial strategy where peace and power intersect. Would you like to maybe riff on that for a minute? Where to begin?
Yeah, it's kind of where we were just speaking about, Michael. Like when we can step off the hamster wheel, we have time to breathe. We have time to actually consider those big questions, right? The big questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What impact do I want to have in the world? Like when you have societies that are thinking and asking those questions, the world changes, right? Like that changes everything. Wars stop, hunger stops. We're able to care for each other in a way that's not possible when we're in a system designed to have us continually run and chase and consume. So, you know, to me, and I'll just say this, and God, I might be answering the question that you always like to ask at the end of.
Go, baby. This is your unpopular opinion. Go for it.
Yeah. You know, a lot of Bitcoiners are in that mode of, you know, if we just change the money, change the world, right? It'll fix everything. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think Bitcoin is a tool. It's a great tool. It's a great start that will give people the opportunity to slow down. But we have to transform. As human beings, we have to shift. If we change the money, it will give us an opportunity to slow down and step off the hamster wheel so we can shift, but we still have to do the work. We still have to start to see the world differently. We still have to start seeing connection rather than separation. Like the conversations that divide us need to start to fall away and disappear. And we have to start seeing another human being for who they are, which is just another human being, which is really a part of me, you know? No separation. Like I always say, if we could see the ultimate reality, we would see that we're all connected. The trap is, you know, a lot of people in Bitcoin are like get attached to a number go up and they see their wealth go up and they puff up their chest and it can create more separation than connection. If we're not doing our inner work, if we're not shifting who we are and how we see the world, and understand that, you know, we're the ones that get to make the change. You know, I've done a lot of work in the last 10 years with people around trauma and healing trauma and the generational trauma. The beautiful thing is people doing that work are awake enough to heal all of that. Like when you do that work, Michael, you change that for your children. So you affect it forward and backward because you alter all of it because you change how you see the past as well. And that creates an opening for those people. And it's like that with money. Like we're the ones awake enough to take action now and start to stack Bitcoin. Like, so there's an obligation with that, I feel. I feel like there's an obligation to share it, to communicate it. And for me, it's a different place because when I was a warrior trying to fight the system from inside, it was a war. I would get in people's faces and ask them and yell at them to wake up to what was going on. that doesn't work. And with Bitcoin, I don't have to do that. It's just an invitation. So I'll keep inviting people. I'll keep sharing with people. And if they will or they won't, they might not today, but they might tomorrow. It's all good. It's all their path. But I feel like I have an obligation to share and to support and serve when I can, however I can. And so that's kind of what I'm up to. So it's not just change the money, change the world. We have to change. We have to change ourselves and how we view the world and how we see people and how we see each other.
I think 12, 18 months ago, I was one of the ones peddling some of these tropes and saying, fix the money, fix the world, and that's it. A dear friend of mine who's actually a client of the Bitcoin Way, I've gotten to know well, and he and I are in sort of constant communication, has really opened me up to ignoring some of the petty, you know, noise that we throw out there and aligning me with this notion of human action is required. Bitcoin will help to align incentives, but at the end of the day, it requires that we as people take steps in the right direction. And honestly, he's been an inspiration for me, and a lot of the things that we're doing is what I think about: homeschooling and canceling health insurance, things that felt like huge decisions at one point in time. If not me, then who? And if I can convince one other family or one other group of friends to begin taking these actions, adopt Bitcoin as their savings vehicle, opt out where they can, get their, you know, instill self-directed thinking into their children. Those are the things that I think are going, those are the ripples and the impact it's going to have long-term, I think are hugely important. So I agree with you. It's going to be an unpopular opinion for many people who have said, fix the money, fix the world on repeat for a long, long time. But I could not possibly agree with you more. I think that people change the world. Money is a tool in that fight for a better world.
Thank God we have a money that is sacred today. We have that opportunity to use that instead of garbage.
Yes.
You know, basically.
Bobby, is there anything that we have not covered that you were hoping to touch on?
Well,
or anything you'd like to close with?
I'm going to promote you guys for a second, because, you know, there's so much noise in the crypto space, and I was distracted by it early on. Like, you know, like shit coins and, you know, like I was just, it's a big distraction because everybody's, especially at that point where you're like, you feel like you're behind, right? I got to catch up. Well, here's how you catch up. Here's this coin's going to do 100x and this, you know. Block out the noise, right? I love your message at the Bitcoin Way. Buy Bitcoin, hold it in self-custody, and continue. Rinse and repeat. Keep buying Bitcoin, hold it in self-custody, do it the right way, learn how to do it, put your head down, and that's it. Like, go to work. That's what to do. Keep it simple. It's not complicated. You know, it's very interesting. I was working with a guy who was a trader, professional trader. And I asked him, I said, so what's your portfolio look like? What's the balance? How balanced is it? He said, well, I'm 90% Bitcoin, 10% in a trading account. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, I can't outperform it. I've been trading for 24 years. I can't outperform Bitcoin. I'm not going to try. My life energy is too valuable. Me spending time with my children and my grandchildren is too important to me sitting in front of a screen trying to figure out charts and, you know, technical analysis and that. He said, I'm just buying Bitcoin. And I thought that said a lot coming from a guy who was a trader for 25 years. So keep it simple, right? What's Jack Mallers say? Stack sats, stay humble. Yeah.
Amen.
So
I think that's a great way to wrap it up. Why don't you, Bobby, tell people where they can find you, where they can read your book?
Yeah, the book's available at theprosperityrebellion.com. If you want to shoot me an email, Bobby@theprosperityrebellion.com. I'm happy to connect with you, talk. share whatever I can. That's why I'm here.
Perfect. Well, Bobby, I would encourage everyone to read this book. It's a great read. It's a fast read. Very fun. Very interesting. You've got a fantastic story. Thank you so much for taking time to come on today.
Thank you, Michael. Take care. Peace.
Cheers. And that's a wrap again. Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bobby. I know I sure did. Go check out the Prosperity Rebellion. Check out his website. Again, there's going to be a link in the description below. And of course, if you need help taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We can also help you with digital sovereignty, taking control of your online life, protecting your computer, your phone. We can help you set up a privacy phone, and we have an incredibly popular Plan B residency option. Slots are filling up if you want to make that trip and open your jurisdictional optionality as well. And if you need help setting up a solo miner, we can help you do that. A lot of other things, a lot of one-off Bitcoin consulting we can do for you as well. Again, thebitcoinway.com/podcast. If you're enjoying the show, the channel, do me a huge favor, like the video, subscribe, share it with a friend, leave a comment, anything to help feed the algorithm and spread the word about Bitcoin as a tool for self-sovereignty. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.